From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the midst of the most recent presidential primary season. It happened on March 15th, 2016, when the New York Times served notice to readers that standards were changing. Editor Margaret Sullivan published a piece titled "Tightening the Screws on Anonymous Sources." Sullivan explained that the Times had made two major front-page errors in a six-month period, both of them due to over-reliance on anonymous sources. As a result, she explained, the New York Times was going to approach anonymous sources with more caution. The official New York Times memo said, quote, "At best, granting anonymity allows us to reveal the atrocities of terror groups, government abuses, or other situations where sources may risk their lives, freedom, or careers by talking to us. In sensitive areas like national security reporting, it can be unavoidable. But in other cases, readers question whether anonymity allows unnamed people to skew a story in favor of their own agenda. In rare cases, we have published information from anonymous sources without enough questions or skepticism, and it has turned out to be wrong," end quote. This week, 2.5 years later, many readers are revisiting that piece in light of the fact that the Times took the extraordinary step of publishing an entire op-ed anonymously. The Times only identified the author last week as a high-ranking member of the Trump administration. The author claimed that some members of the administration essentially police the president like a toddler, making sure his more dangerous or juvenile ideas are not put into practice. The piece was meant to be reassuring to the American public, a kind of comment that there are adults essentially in charge. But for many, it was confusing. Why is this Trump official not resigning? And if this official believes it's vital to keep watch over the president, why write a piece for the New York Times anonymously saying so? Journalism professor and press critic Jay Rosen says the New York Times has struggled to keep anonymous sources under control despite their promise in 2016. Journalist and activist Glenn Greenwald was similarly critical. In this hour, a conversation about standards in journalism and anonymous sources. Our guests in studio include, from a long, long way away, Randy Gorbman, news director for WXXI.
Right across the hall. Thanks, Evan.
Nice to have you here. Nice to have you in this studio here. Vanessa Cheeks is a reporter for Open Mic Rochester. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Hi.
And Megan McDermott is taxes and property watchdog reporter, among other assignments, for the Democrat and Chronicle. Megan, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you.
And
it's
in a moment,
here.
We expect to be joined by Jack Rosenberry, who's a journalism professor at St. John Fisher College, who himself had a lot to say on this subject last week. So I'll just start with asking our guests, if you were surprised to see an entire op-ed anonymously, I can't think of too many like that, having seen it, Randy.
No, I think the Times said they did it at least once before, and I don't remember that time offhand, but I know we'll talk about this today, and I guess if I'll start off the bat saying if I had any issues with this, it was the fact that if this person is important enough, high enough in the administration and had something that Americans really needed to hear, I would have preferred that it be handled as a news story. But that's probably, at least at this point, my preference for the journalism here.
So in other words, if this person comes to the Times newsroom and says, I'm willing to speak anonymously but very bluntly about what's going on that I think the American people should know, even if they want to grant anonymity, you think it should have been reported under somebody else's byline as a news story, as opposed to saying, okay, here's your anonymous.
It seemed a bit, at least, again, my opinion, it seemed a bit too self-serving. We know that certainly senior administration officials, from what we hear over the years in Washington, will let themselves be quoted without their name being used. But we often think that perhaps there's an agenda behind what they're doing. And in this case, that's the feel I got by reading this, that I would have felt a bit better about it had it been vetted by the news department as opposed to by the folks who are handling the op-ed part of it.
Okay. Vanessa, were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised. There's a lot of talk of anonymous sources. Even the president himself, you know, mentions them in his tweets or, you know, in stories. And so I think that I don't want to say it was a logical step, but it definitely wasn't surprising in itself. And I think I definitely agree. It was interesting to see it in an op-ed format where typically that's a lot of conjecture and opinion. But it was definitely an interesting read, put it that way.
to say the very least. Megan, any surprise from you on this one?
Yes, I was surprised. And I'm with Randy, I think, on that. I would have preferred this to be a story in the paper. I think it would have been perhaps people would have been better served had the news organization had the opportunity to, you know, investigate what was in there. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people also who have said that this was kind of a cowardly move on the part of whomever this was in the administration, and that if they really felt strongly enough about this, then they should be willing to put their name behind it. It seemed to me unprecedented. I don't recall the Times ever doing something like that, and I've had some discussion with my colleagues in the newsroom, and I don't know that we would have run something similar.
Yeah, and as we go throughout the hour, I think listeners will be interested in standards. I mean, every newsroom has slightly different standards, or at least ideas, general guidelines. We'll talk about that. But I go back to what Margaret Sullivan wrote in March of 2016 and the memo from the New York Times acknowledging that, you know, absent someone maybe risking their job or their life, that there's often an agenda here. And I did not read that op-ed, Randy, confident that it wasn't all about possible agenda. There's too much possible agenda going on.
Right. I mean, they in fact, the Times even referenced, you know, sometimes we use anonymous sources, and they talked about it was someone under extreme duress, and I apologize, I forgot it was Central America, or it was someone who was under, you know, perhaps death threats, that sort of thing, different kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And I understand that to a better extent, even in an op-ed piece. But in this case, you know, Washington is all about politics, and that's the feel I got from it. Sure, what this person is saying, a lot of it may have very well been true, but you know, why come out now at this particular time, and why was it you know, important enough that you felt you should talk about it? But hey, I want to keep my job, so I'm not going to give my name, so I can still work here.
Yeah, and so I think of even recent stories we've done, and I think of Randy Gorbman. At times, giving me all kinds of grief in the most important way. There are conversations that happen in every newsroom. Do we have enough to publish? How many sources do we have? What's on the record? What is not? We've reported on everything from how the county approaches the opioid crisis to Parcel 5 and recent questions on what's going on with that site and who's going to develop it. I mean, I remember just in those 10, 12 days of reporting on Parcel 5, when we were learning a lot of things that nobody in the community publicly seemed to have known about, and I would get off the phone with someone, they'd say, well, here, I'll give you something on background, but you cannot use my name. You cannot use my name. You cannot use my name. And it was very frustrating. But the boss let us know, and we all agree on this. You eventually need somebody on the record. You have to have someone
I think
on the record.
The DNC, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think probably a lot of us, Megan, may be in the same general sphere as far as I think you guys triangulate with maybe three sources for on
we
image.
Do. We have a really high bar for using anonymous sources in that way, like quoting them in a story. Our editor, knows who they are. I mean, these aren't people that nobody knows who a source is, you know, and we also have to try to find at least three independent sources who will confirm that information. And we try to, as you said, triangulate, and that means, you know, if the information comes from, you know, the Democratic side, we're also trying to find people from other sides in that, the Republicans who might be able to confirm that information too, so that you're not forwarding somebody's agenda. You know, and going back to that piece in the Times, you know, Washington right now is really consumed with the who wrote it. And really the bigger question, it seems to me, is the why. And that gets back to that agenda. You know, the New York Times in some ways has sort of staked its reputation on this piece, you know, and the bigger question is, why would somebody inside of the administration do such a thing?
And that's exactly that question. Has so many different possible answers that the Times could say, look, well, we know who this man or woman or whoever, we know who this is. So we're confident that we at least understand possible. But the reader does not. And there are so many different, if it's, and I'm sure, I don't know. If it's Mike Pence, I'm sure it's not. If it's Dan Coats, whoever it is, they would all have different reasons for doing it, potentially.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And that's why I'm with our panel on this, that put it as a news piece if you really feel the need to do that. And you're also sort of bringing up this idea of what independent means. I already have an email from a listener named Mark who wants to know, well, what does it mean to be an independent set of sources? We'll get to that question in a moment. I'll let our listeners know. I want to hear from you on anonymous sources. We're going to talk about trust in journalism. Do you trust journalism, generally speaking, right now? Are you confident that what you're reading in the Times or the Democrat and Chronicle open mic, hearing on WXXI, NPR. Do you feel good about it? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I also think about a recent-ish open mic piece on the ongoing legacy of Mayor Lovely Warren that you guys worked really hard on. You had a lot of people quoted on the record.
Yeah.
You had people in government. You had people in community leadership positions. Some of them saying really flattering things. Some of them saying really challenging things that would have been easier to say, you know, look, I'll tell you this, but don't use my name. Sometimes it's a lot of work to get someone to say, I'll tell you this and you can use my name, but there's real value there.
There's value there. There's also trust there. I think that a lot of times people who act as sources, they have to trust that you're going to treat that information with respect and not twist it and put it into context. You know, someone can say something challenging about Mayor Lovely Warren or about anything, and, you know, quotes are long. You usually sit down with someone for a long time and you get a lot of information, and it is very easy to take snippets of it and turn it into something that maybe isn't entirely accurate or doesn't paint the full picture. But as a journalist, it's not just about writing it. It's about following a code of ethics. I know me personally, I would never, I don't operate off the record. I have had a lot of people look at me and like, oh, it's off the record. And I'm like, let me tell you right now, it's not. So before you go any further, you need to understand that unless you are an anonymous source and there's a whole different way to operate that way, we are not, don't tell me anything you don't want me to write. And I think being honest with the source is extremely important because it might affect what they say or how they say it. And so, you know, that to me, I think it says a lot about the journalist as well. So
that's interesting, Vanessa, that you essentially lay it down that we're not going to do any off the record. Because I think reporters, it's really easy to let somebody drift into off the record. Like, okay, all right, we're off the record for a little while here. But I think maybe that the overuse of that could lead to an assumption that I can tell you a bunch of things, but you're never going to ask me to be on the record.
I think people watch too many movies. That's what I think it is. They see somebody in a movie and they sit down and, like, you know, the reporter goes to three different payphones and they finally meet the source and the source is like, okay, but you can't print my name. This is off the record. That's not how it works.
So. Not everything is all the president's men. And exactly. That, Randy Gorman, is part of what the New York Times was saying 2.5 years ago is, you know, maybe what they were admitting was an over-reliance on anonymous sources that, hey, I really want this quote in this piece. It would really help. Okay, let's use it. But if you really look at it individually in the standards picture, what's the reason here? Is this person truly in danger? Is their job in danger? Is national security in danger? Most of the time, the answer is no.
I want to come at it from a slightly different perspective, and I think Megan used to cover, correct me if I'm wrong, suburbs to some extent. Or those
kind
of things. A lot of us cutting our teeth in journalism, and I won't say how many decades ago it was for me, we started out doing all the town board meetings and the school board meetings, and I've covered them all, and the county ledge meetings that went on for hours and all that sort of thing.
And right there with you.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, one thing about those, just as a counterpoint to what Vanessa was talking about, and I totally I respect that, you know, you don't want to drift into this kind of netherworld of, you know, on the record, off the record. On the other side of that is when you get to know some of the people in the local towns, local school districts, you know, whatever, you do sometimes, at least I found, it was helpful to me to get stuff on background in terms of information where I really wasn't interested in quoting that particular person, but they maybe were, again, in the county ledge for a long time, or they remember the school board for a long time, and I found it helpful if, you know, we had a relationship where we trusted each other, where they knew that, hey, right now, can you just give me some background? And I would be clear about it. Say, hey, can you tell me just on background what's going on here? And in those cases, I would not quote them. And that relationship for a reporter, at least I found, was very valuable where you could get information without the person worrying they would be quoted. Again, it doesn't happen all the time, but
sure,
there are times when it's helpful.
But when you get information and someone doesn't want you to use their name, you should be skeptical at first, or at least skeptical enough to respect that person, but want to really vet and carefully.
Oh, absolutely.
Vet. And that's where Mark's email on what do you mean by independent sources. Give me an example, right? If you want three sources on something, but what does an independent source? It doesn't just mean three independent people if they all work alongside each other in the same office.
Right. I mean, we're looking for people who have knowledge of the situation, hopefully. And you mentioned before, if it's a political story, you'd like to get somebody from the major parties, if, again, it's something that is splitting along Republican-Democratic lines. And it would be good to get somebody who's a little bit at a distance, you know, kind of following the story. Maybe it's somebody, let's say it's a story, you know, let's say for whatever reason, I'm not picking on county government, let's say it's county government. You knew somebody who was perhaps maybe not a high-level official, but had some knowledge of the way the processes work, knew what was going on, and could be independent in that sense that they weren't actually part of that particular department, but could give you some perspective on what's going on.
Okay. Megan, how would you answer Mark's question on sources there?
I think it's along the same lines. You want people who don't have the same agenda. And I think that Randy sort of brought that up. But you'd be looking for somebody who has direct knowledge in any ways that you can find that out. Or the person who knows how the paper moves through the agency would be able to help you out, you know, if you were looking at something that had to do with legislation or maybe the misappropriation of funds, you know. And you're not looking for necessarily even all politicians. You want to find the people behind that who really know more.
Okay, now I'll get our first phone call. We'll come back to your emails. You can communicate with the program many ways. We mentioned the phone number, 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program, you can email us at connections@wxxi.org. You can find us on our social media platforms, including on Twitter at Evan Dawson or at producer Megan Mack at MMack Media. Rick on the phone first. Go ahead, Rick.
Hey, hi. I heard Randy and I believe Megan both express the opinion that it might have been better for the New York Times to have done a news article. I guess my confusion is when I think of a news article, I think of you triangulate sources, et cetera, because the paper is essentially signing off on the very, very likely truthfulness of the facts in the article based on multiple sources, whereas in this case, it's more a question of because it's just an op-ed, because they chose not to do a news article, essentially what the New York Times is signing off on is just the identity, the truthfulness of the identity of the fact that it's a senior official in the Trump White House, and that seemed, so that's, to me, that seemed appropriate based on the very high unlikelihood of being able to get multiple sources to actually clear the facts within the editorial. So for me, it seemed appropriate, and also it seemed fitting for what the New York Times editorial board has acknowledged is kind of very different times. And so in this particular case, it seemed to make, and it was an editorial board decision that we will sign off just on the identity, and we need to give this person a voice.
Okay, and so, Rick, let me just kind of follow up with you, and then I'll turn it over to the panel. And I understand exactly where your mind's going with this. Do you expect that before the New York Times decided to publish this op-ed, they tried to do some legwork to find out if the op-ed is going to be accurate? In other words, it's one high-ranking official, but the official is making factual claims, such as there are people who are sort of policing policy or blocking things from happening or trying to prevent war, et cetera. And do you think even if they want to grant an op-ed to a high-ranking official, if there's factual claims, should they also try to source that out and report that out before they allow the person to have an op-ed space?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. My guess is that, yes, they did, in fact,
I hope so
to some
too.
Extent, verify it. Even if it was only in the form of the main writer of the editorial giving them specific names, but saying, we can't, obviously, I won't be using specific names kind of thing. Even if it was as simple as that, I don't know whether they tried to contact those individuals, the other high-ranking officials that theoretically are part of this protective barrier, but it would be nice to know that.
Yeah, and that's why I ask, because, you know, I'll go around the table on this one here. You know, Randy, I think in this case, your preference for a news story would have brought those new standards into reporting. I do hope they did that kind of reporting before giving this space, because if that person does have an agenda, whether, and again, I don't think it's the vice president, I have no insight into who it is, but let's say it's the vice president on down, they could have their own agendas. And if they're the only person making these claims, now you got Bob Woodward's book, you can claim that it's sort of been, but I hope that reporting was done.
I would too. And I mean, the people who handled the oversight of it, I know their editorial page editors are both experienced reporters. Same here. I mean, I'm hoping that they took a careful look at what the person had to say and said, Yeah, I mean, we can see some of these issues have come up. Now it's someone is putting voice to them. Again, it was just my preference still to see it as a news story, but yeah. I get what Rick is talking about. And I would assume it's the New York Times, a very credible publication. I would hope that they had taken a close look at what the agenda might have been of the person who was writing it.
Yeah, and maybe just to kind of build on that, Randy, if I'm in that newsroom, maybe at a meeting, I float the idea, okay, if we want to give an op-ed space to one of the sources, let's get multiple sources and let's do two things. Let's have a news headline in which we say Trump administration senior officials policing him and actively thwarting policy, joined by an op-ed that explains why, if we can source that out, as opposed to just the op-ed.
Yeah, I agree. That actually, to me, an ideal world, and nothing really is.
Yeah.
I would love to have seen both, or I would have been fine with an op-ed piece and a news story also.
Okay. Vanessa, go ahead.
That would have given additional context to the piece that I think was lacking by running it on its own. You know, I think that was the failing. If they had one,
but that would have required, it would have required multiple sources, and I don't know how easy it is to get them on. I mean, looking at what the one person is going through right now, likely, it would have been very tough to get the multiple sources in this particular case. I don't know.
Yeah, and Rick, that's why there's a danger in if you don't have more sources or if we don't know. I mean, any of this change your mind on this, Vanessa? What do you think?
I love op-eds. I think they're a great way for people to voice, you know, what they're thinking without really having to delve deep. You don't have to be an investigative reporter to share your opinion. But with this particular case, I think after reading it a few times, it is an op-ed. There is no fact. You can say, you know, there's this group of people who are, you know, going against the president in their own little way, but there is no way to prove that to be true. And so I think that had it been a news story and had there been facts to vet, I don't even know if it would have made me feel better about the situation. It would have just been better, more informational. But I feel like it's a tough situation because it is a true op-ed, which it serves its own purpose. It gives this person a voice and it gives that insight that I think the New York Times was looking for. But I don't necessarily think it serves the public in a way that they thought it would.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Christine, Rick, thank you. Really interesting stuff. Christine in Canandaigua. Go ahead, Christine.
Yes, I consider these folks whistleblowers, and they need their confidentiality to remain effective, and I'm glad they're working from within.
So you read the anonymous op-ed, and you think, hooray for the publication, and you're glad it unfolded the way it did.
Yes, I think that we need some help in these strange times that we're in, and I'm glad we have folks keeping our back from within.
Okay.
Yes, I think they need their. If we knew who they are, you know who, would not have them there anymore.
Christine, thank you. So. I think of what Dan Dresner and Ross Douthat wrote when the president's inauguration was unfolding that week. And they said, even though they are both what they would call never Trump Republicans, they were hoping for really competent conservatives to serve this administration because they don't want a bunch of incompetent people running Washington. And I think they still feel largely the same. And this op-ed reflects that. It reflects what Christine is saying, which is it's nice to know people have our back, even if it's from the inside. But does it serve the public to tell the public? Because now you have an administration that really is trying to root this out. The president has asked the Justice Department, do we need to have it? I don't know that the op-ed, Randy, was there enough reassurance to the public versus the possible backlash from within administration that gets enough of a public good for airing it this way?
Yeah, I don't know. Again, the whole public good thing, I guess I have to be convinced on that.
Yeah.
And the only reason, again, I say that, and I don't mean to keep harping on the motive thing, but I'd be curious, again, to see who the person was in terms of his or her background and why it would benefit or not benefit them to, you know, to stay anonymous. And I'd also, you know, be curious to see if there is more than just these feelings are expressed by more than just this one person. And as the, you know, callers have mentioned, we may never find that out. But I'd be, you know, curious if, again, if this person is outed, becomes a scapegoat, gets fired by Trump, whatever, you know, are there more, or is this person, you know, again, have an agenda where they're just kind of espouse this, and maybe there aren't as many people as he or she would lead you to believe.
And Vanessa, you're tough with people who want to go on background or want to go off the record. This is an extraordinary circumstance. Christine views this, and she used the term strange times. Mm-hmm. Is this a circumstance that rises to that level for you that says, okay, you know, we will go not only go off the record here, we're going to give you the space. Is it an extraordinary time?
You know, I think that any source, you know, whether you're, you know, a whistleblower, as she said, in a small level in a company, or you work for the president, I feel like preserving your job and preserving your family's dignity, it is, I think, it can make an argument for anonymity, yes. Eventually, this person may need to come forward. I definitely don't.
Publicly, maybe.
Yeah, publicly, yeah. Yes. And whether that's, you know, after this administration has run its course, or, you know, and if they, you know, feel like this op-ed is getting enough traction that they should, you know, come forward. But I didn't really necessarily get a political agenda from it, more so that, like, somebody wants to stand on top of the hill and say, don't worry, guys, we got this. It doesn't make me feel better, because there's still a lot of trouble within the administration that this particular person has said, you know, that they are still for. And so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this person basically, I agree with what you're saying, but this person basically is, unless I'm missing something, did not disavow, seems to be generally in favor of the Trump agenda. So it's not like that's
true.
Mickey
just don't
news.
Like him.
They just don't like him. So again, you take it at face value, I guess.
Yeah, and would you put this, Christine and Canandaigua, Megan, put this in the whistleblower category? Would you?
I don't know that I would. One, I don't know that this is necessarily new news. I mean, we've certainly been hearing before from other outlets and other
Maggie
reporters.
Maggie Haberman herself and other reporters for the Times
have
done stories like that.
Absolutely. And you take this in conjunction with the Woodward book, and he's really reporting on many of the same things. So I don't know that it's necessarily whistleblowing. You know, it's not someone bringing forward some terrible piece of legislation or terrible action that could, you know, endanger them or their job. And it's also, you know, taking a larger view, we're looking at a situation where there's been a president who's been duly elected by the people, and then this is apparently a group within the White House that's working to subvert some of his aims. And that's a real question the American people should think about. You know, regardless of who's in that office, is this something that we want going on?
That's a fair question. And before I get our only break in the hour, and then we're going to come back to Jay in Rochester, and we'll take some of your emails. I don't like thinking like this, but I'm only human, so I'm just going to kind of work through what I might say in a newsroom meeting, whether it was here or the New York Times or elsewhere. Right now, you've got tens of millions of voters who still support this president who don't really trust what they would call mainstream media. And when they see a piece claiming that the president is sort of juvenile and he's being thwarted by adults on his team who happen to be Republicans, who want a conservative agenda, but they just don't want that guy, but we won't put a name on it, and we'll allow him to do it, I'm worried that whatever public good we think is happening here is maybe outweighed by the fact that you may be giving ammunition to supporters of the president who say, oh, I see, you don't even have the guts to get this person on the record. You're just trying to use more space to attack him.
And that's already been brought out, I think, I've read it, might have been in Pointer, that organization, or some others, but that is a concern in the era of quote-unquote labeling the president's fake news. Does this give ammunition? Maybe, I don't know.
It's strange that we have to think about that, but I think at least should have been part of the, I'm not saying it's the central consideration, but it's out there.
No, absolutely, and the proliferation of anonymous sourcing tends to give credence to people who don't believe in what journalists are doing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, that's why you need to be so very careful about when you're using them.
Let's get that only break of the hour. And we'll come back. We'll take more of your phone calls. I want to read what journalist Glenn Greenwald said about this kerfuffle with the op-ed and anonymous sources. He had some very tough words for journalism writ large on this. Our guests include the news director of WXXI, Randy Gorbman, in studio with us, along with Vanessa Cheeks, a reporter for Open Mic Rochester, and Megan McDermott, a taxes and property watchdog reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle. We're right back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Merriam-Webster has added hundreds of new words to the dictionary. Now, they do this periodically. I always wonder when I see the list, how long are these words going to be in common use? Words like hangry, self-harm, time suck, Instagramming, adorbs. Why does the dictionary do this, and should it follow popular culture? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Jay in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Jay.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to go back to retribution a little bit. You may have already touched on this, but Strunken Water was a long time ago, but it seems to me that, if I remember correctly, it's kind of incumbent on the interviewer or the journalist to clarify at the beginning of the conversation to what degree the conversation can actually be referred to. Deep background, lesser background, off the record, flat out off the record, on the record. That, it seems to me, has to be clarified absolutely at the beginning of the conversation. If you go back over the Woodward-Trump thing, you'll see that exactly what was said was that Woodward was kind of dancing around that. He was equivocating a little bit. And Trump kind of fell into it. He said, well, I really don't know if I should be discussing this. I really don't know. He equivocated. He obviously wasn't clear about the rules. And I think, if I remember correctly, it's up to the journalist to absolutely make it clear to the person who's being interviewed. Exactly the degree to which that conversation will be referred to.
Yeah, Jay, that's, first of all, I think that's all important and relevant here. I would advise anybody who ever talks to a journalist, considering their job is to collect information, that if you are talking to a journalist, you can assume it could be on the record, or it is on the record, unless you try to specify it otherwise. Now, I will say this, and I'll turn to my boss first on this one. When I talk to people in politics, in public work, political life, I think most of us have had some moment where someone will say, okay, well, hold on. All that stuff we just talked about, that's got to be off the record. And they try to sort of retroactively do that. They should know the rules and they should know better.
Right. And especially if you're in politics and you've done this before, don't pull that.
Yeah, exactly.
don't even try it.
Whereas someone who is not living in sort of political or public life and doesn't have experience with this may not realize that, and then may say, wait a second, I was just talking to you, that wasn't for like publication. You can be really kind of a hard technical person.
But I've been understanding in cases like that, depending on the situation.
I think it all depends case by case, and we try to be human beings as journalists.
Right.
But people in political or public life, I'm not a big fan
when
I hear that whole,
right, I agree.
Everything I just told you is off the record. Have you heard that before?
People in political and public life should already know the rules.
Yeah.
but people, private people, often don't. And you do need to negotiate these things beforehand.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can't have a conversation and then retroactively try to say this is all off the record. And I, too, will be kind and understanding to people who don't know those rules. But typically, you know, if you're talking to a reporter without having some kind of a negotiation or agreement beforehand, it's on the record. And you've told it to me, it is on the record.
Vanessa Cheeks, what do you think?
I mean, a core tenet of journalism is to do no harm, to treat sources like human beings. So I think there is a little grace with people who might not be familiar or are in stressful situations. Mm-hmm. And you should be clear, especially if the information is sensitive. But I think, yeah, I mean, politicians know the rules. My job is to collect information. And if you're talking to me and then you're going to attempt to take that information away from me, that's not going to work. And
what do you do if they say, well, fine, you use that and I'll never talk to you again?
Ooh. You know, initially part of it depends on, I mean, if it's Watergate, sorry. You already told me. But like I said, if there's another way for me to take that information that you already gave me and, like we talked about earlier, vet it with someone else, no harm, no foul, that's fine. But if you're my only source or you're my gateway, you're the person keeping me from really telling the story, I will revisit this and we'll continue to have a conversation about it to see if you change your mind. And if not, then I will talk to my editor and we will figure it out.
Well, I think generally speaking, again, it's case by case.
Yeah.
How sensitive, how vital
is
it? But generally what I would say to something like that is, you know, I'm really disappointed if that's the case because I hope that you can trust my professional track record, but I've got a job to do and, you know, I can't be bullied into being pushed off a story. What do you say in that spot, Megan? Because you've probably heard it before, by the way.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But in the best case scenario, I wouldn't use them at all. I'd go find that information out from somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, but if it really came down to it, you know, I'd have a discussion with my editor. It's possible I'd roll the dice on it and that, you know, at some later point in time when having another story about something else was useful, this person would call me up and talk to me again anyway.
Okay.
I'm not in the business of trying to harm people. Again, you know, I'm trying to be fair and accurate and put forth good information. But if somebody's told me something juicy and said that, you know, I can't use it, well, I need to pull out all my other reporting tools and figure out how to get that on the record from somebody.
Okay.
And just kind of going back to what you said at the beginning, and for budding journalists out there, and I just, Evan and I came across this with a story recently, when someone says they're giving you information on background, you really need to establish, does that mean you can use the information without their name, or is it on such deep background that you can't even use the information? And
right.
I think we had that issue with a story recently, and I think you really need to clarify that ahead of time, or then you start to run into problems.
Sure. Here is, on the subject of anonymous sources and motivation and agenda, Peter in Pittsford emails with a real humdinger of an idea here. Peter says, how about the possibility that the anonymous New York Times op-ed is not what it seems at all? What if its actual purpose is to present the deep state as real and tangible and turn Woodward's book into a boon for Trump's base so his supporters can say, see, I told you this was real. Now do you see why we need Trump? That's another level of motivation.
That certainly.
I watch Homeland on Showtime. And I've seen this plot. I've heard it. It may not be true.
Yeah,
but
I'm not quite there,
maybe
Peter.
Maybe only on pay TV.
I'm not quite there, Peter, but I will say this, Peter. Just the fact that we can speculate about motive with anonymous sources indicates you really have to be careful in using them at all. Because this is what it leads to, stuff like this. Let's go to Tom in Spencerport next on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
I don't know if any of you watched Smirkanish on CNN this weekend.
I didn't see him. I'm aware of Mike, but I didn't see it this weekend.
He interviewed a New York Times reporter. Might have been a White House reporter. And was asking her about, you know, what did they know about the anonymous source, whatever, and they said they didn't. But she said, and you can verify this, that actually the op-ed was brought to the New York Times by a friend of this person. It sounds like the same thing that Comey did with an agenda. He didn't. So my question is, do they actually know who it is, or are they taking the word of the friend who brought it to them, who's saying it was a senior White House official? You can go watch the show. It's right there. But so the question is there an agenda? And it's all what we hear now is it's all the same as the Woodward book and the prior stuff, except for this 25th Amendment stuff. And now you hear the Democrats all wanting to have hearings on, you know, is he stable? Should we be invoking the 25th Amendment? So, and the other thing I just heard you talking about was the off the record. But have you guys commented about Bloomberg taking Trump's off the record comment and publicizing it, saying it was off the record and publicizing it about Canada or CNN, where Lanny Davis says he was the anonymous source and said he was wrong?
Yeah.
And then CNN won't even accept that. So, I mean, it seems like there's a double standard here. I think the standards you're talking about are great, but when people don't apply them, you really wonder, especially if I'm true, and I don't know if this is true, that the op-ed from the New York Times was the first one they published anonymously. Is that right?
No, first or second, but let me hit this from a couple different ways here, because you bring up the Lanny Davis thing, and this is important. When CNN decided to stand by their story, in spite of the fact that Lanny Davis came out and said, hey, you know that story 6 months ago? I was their anonymous source, and what I told them was false. What CNN is sort of de facto saying to its audience is, guys, we had other sources too, and we're sticking by that story. Now it's a question of trust. Do you trust them or not? And right now, the effort underway is to undermine trust in journalism. So the more you use anonymous sources, the more you open yourself up to exactly that. CNN standing by in the face of Lanny Davis, I simply took that as them saying, we have other sources. He's not the only one, and we're not bothered by whatever he's claiming, because you know you can take that for what it is. It's a matter of trust here. And I want to read what Glenn Greenwald had to say about this, because he's tough about this. He wrote the following, quote, media outlets pretend there are complex, deeply ethical, highly intricate considerations governing when they grant anonymity to powerful people to say things. It's a sham. The tortured debates are theater. The actual standard is we grant anonymity when powerful people demand it. There is no singular reason people have lost faith and trust in media outlets. People often emphasize the reason they find themselves most offensive. But certainly the promiscuous grant of anonymity to allow powerful people to spew garbage with no accountability is a big factor. The key journalistic lesson of the Iraq War was supposedly that the New York Times and other media outlets recklessly allowed government officials to spew lies and propaganda while hiding behind anonymity. They all vowed reform. Does anyone think they have reformed? Anonymity is now more reckless than ever, end quote. That's tough words from journalist Glenn Greenwald. What do you think, Randy?
You know, I'm just really not sure about this, the motivation, again, of the person involved. I mean, I think in terms of, first of all, to the caller's last point, the person who had talked about whether or not this, they had, according to the Times anyway, I don't have it pulled up on my phone right now, but they had vetted through an intermediary and conversations with the person. I assume it was over the phone. That it was indeed the person. You know, whether or not you know, we're looking at this in the broader context of you know, what Greenwald is talking about, I'm just a little uncomfortable with the op-ed as it is, you know, by itself. And it's not that I'm necessarily impugning the motives of the person who wrote it, but I'm also at the same time I don't want the press to be unfairly painted as, especially the New York Times, which is kind of frankly symbolic for a lot of us, as just to be an example of, sure, here's another example of what, you know, what journalism has become, and because it gets a lot of hits on their website, that's why they're doing it. So I just, you know, even if the Times motives were pure in this, I'm questioning whether or not it's going to be viewed that way.
Okay, Vanessa?
I definitely, to your point, yes, you know, that was one of the first things I read when I looked over the op-ed, was that it was vetted. So to answer that question, I think any paper that would publish something like this without doing their own footwork shouldn't be in business. But it was also vetted with other people who were within the administration and who have already left. You know, they've corroborated this type of same sentiment. So I think that for an op-ed would do, perhaps. I mean, to your point, Evan, I operate under a code of ethics. I I would hope that other journalists do. It's definitely something that was not an option when, you know, you're in journalism school and you're sitting in class. They drill that into you, and I feel like as a journalist, if you don't operate that way, if you don't already feel those things, it'll catch up to you sooner or later. So I think that holds true for the individual journalists, but also these publications as well. So
okay, Megan?
You know, I'm actually a bit with Greenwald on this. I think that some news organizations have taken the use of anonymous sources far, way too far. They rely too often on them, and they use them in ways that aren't always serving the public good. You know, they're more serving the agendas of the person who doesn't want to be quoted. And to some extent, you're seeing, like, the fruits of that roll down, you know, even in, you know, say, local administrations or where you're getting spokespeople who will give you a statement and say, oh, but you can't use my name with that.
Yeah,
just
right.
Say an anonymous source. And that's garbage, you know, frankly. But the reason that we need to be so careful about when we use anonymous sources is exactly that reason, because it undermines people's trust in a news organization. You brought up that Margaret Sullivan column where there were two front page corrections because of stories that had been based on anonymous sourcing. Well, if the reporters maybe had done more legwork, had done more to try to nail that down before relying on an anonymous source, you wouldn't have taken that hit to your credibility. And I think, you know, I think Greenwald's a little bit right in that. You know, and I think it's unfair for other news organizations that don't use those same standards. You know, our standards at the Democrat and Chronicle are incredibly high. It's rare that we'll use an anonymous source. And when we do, they are typically in law enforcement situations where the person actually generally can't speak to us, you know, on the record about these things. But we are very, very cautious about it, and for good reason, because I think that over-reliance on them, you know, undermines credibility.
Anonymous Tim writes to us. That's how he identifies himself. I assume Tim doesn't have a last name, but I'm going to read Tim's email. He says, the reason why a journalist wants someone on the record is because any bad heat is transferred to that person and off the journalist. It's like saying, hey, it's not my problem, go after that guy, and everybody does. First of all, I'm going to cut into Tim's email and say, I don't agree with that construction, but we'll get back to that in a moment. Tim says, as a reader, it's all about trusting the journalist in the first place. So if you trust the journalist, then you should trust their sources are legit. In many ways, it makes trusted journalists more legit and the information more incendiary when their sources are anonymous, end quote. I do agree with Tim's latter point that your view of anonymous sources should be directly related to how much you trust that outlet. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
If WXXI or NPR or the New York Times or Open Mic or the Democrat and Chronicle decides to use anonymous sources, you should be able to communicate to your readers or listeners or viewers what are your standards, why you would or would not use them, and what you would hope is you've got a track record in which the consuming public says, well, this is pretty extraordinary, but I trust this. So to that point, I think Tim's making a good one. The notion, Randy, that just getting people on the record is to direct heat away from us to somebody on the record.
Oh, if only misplaced. That was true.
Yeah, exactly right.
I would be quoting everyone from here until, no, seriously.
Yeah.
You know, frankly, the heat part of it, is it comes with the territory. And at this point in my long journalistic career, it takes a lot to insult me. So really, I just want to be our organization to be considered credible. That's the most important thing. And if, you know, we tend to use, you know, few anonymous sources, if that makes us more credible, I'm all for that. But again, as you mentioned, there are times, and not just in this political sense, but we may do a story, as we have recently, with people who are undocumented immigrants, and we feel their story is important to get out. We may not use their full identity. Those situations, I feel, it sometimes is warranted. Again, but I don't like, and I know Megan alluded to this, and I think Vanessa did earlier, the over-reliance of anonymous sources does bother me in general.
Okay. Well, what do you guys make of the email? I don't think we're just quoting people to take the heat off us.
No, and I think you know, when you're printing or publishing this information, the buck stops there. Regardless of who gave you that information, and you're right. quoting them, or they're an anonymous source, you are presenting these facts and this story right. to the public. And so, any problems that the public has, you know, they're looking at you and they see you, and that's, I feel like, as it should be. I think if you were able to, as a journalist, if I was able to go, well, you know what, why don't you focus your anger or your attention or whatever on my source, I don't think that that's right at all. So
yeah, we all take heat, Megan.
Yeah.
Well, we do. We do.
That's, you know, part of the
there
deal.
There was sort of one other thing that I wanted to bring up that I hear, you know, outside from people who contact me and sort of radio chatter on other stations, perhaps. When we talk about anonymous sources, we're not talking about people that the reporter doesn't know who they are. I mean, these are real, actual people. We know who they are.
It's not an unmarked letter that showed up in the newsroom.
Right. Our editors know
too,
who
the
they
we
are.
We do get those.
We do. And sometimes those come from tipsters, and sometimes, you know, those are great, but you have to vet everything.
Yeah.
But anonymous sources aren't sources that, you know, someone who calls up the newsroom with a sock over the phone and whispers me information isn't going to get a story.
Yeah,
unless I can nail that down.
It's not a Mark Felt for every story. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, anonymous source just means we know who they are, but we are keeping their identity concealed for a reason and an agreement that we still think there's a journalistic public good to doing it this way. And as we get ready to wrap the hour, John emails the program and says there's been some criticism of the op-ed. He says, here's a viewpoint from someone completely outside of journalism. If you're an officer on a ship that's being commanded by a dangerously unstable captain who's risking the lives of thousands of passengers, you'd have many options. You could speak to your commanding officer, be relieved of your duties, and put ashore at the next port, thereby escaping the situation and saving your own skin. Or you might risk your own safety, quietly circulate a written notice to the passengers alerting them that their lives are under threat, and stay at your post to help grab the wheel if the captain steams towards an iceberg. Which course of action would be more heroic? That's from John, essentially defending the notion of writing an op-ed anonymously in the New York Times, as we saw. Okay, so some final thoughts here. And Randy Gorman, I know WXXI, we do have those moments more than people think of saying, well, we've got this information. We need someone on the record. It's a pain. There's an art to getting someone to go on the record. There are times where I think I'm pretty good. There are times I wish I were better, but it's part of the job.
Right. And again, just real briefly, you and I both know we worked on a story recently along those lines, and it was a lot of gnashing of teeth, but I felt a lot better by the time we finished the vetting process than I did before, when we weren't really sure whether or not we'd have enough sources to do the story.
No question about it. Vanessa Cheeks, final thoughts from you.
A penny for every story I wasn't able to publish because I couldn't get the sources that I needed. Yeah.
Megan.
Absolutely. Same boat. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let me go ahead and read what the New York Times does describe as their own standards as we close the hour, because we've talked a lot about what they do, and if you're wondering what they are, there's essentially four rules. Number one, anonymous sourcing requires one of three top editors to review and sign off on articles that depend primarily on information from unnamed sources, particularly those that hinge on a central fact from such a source. Number two, the process may result in slowing down before publishing. Number three, it also underscores that an editor must know the identity of an unnamed source. And number four, the newer policy, as of March 2016, aims to significantly ratchet down the use of anonymous sources and anonymous quotation, especially in the New York Times. The preference in the Times is to make such quotation relatively rare. That is up to all of us to decide if they are meeting those standards and if anonymous quotation is rare. But to Megan McDermott's point, and the New York Times has it right there in their written policy, anonymous does not mean you don't know who they are. You know the identity. And to Randy's point, sometimes you slow down. And slowing down
is
hard. You'd rather be right
than fast.
You'd rather be right than fast. Thank you for popping in here, Randy Gorman.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Always nice to have our news director here. You can read Vanessa Cheeks' work in Open Mic Rochester, and it's always nice to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Megan McDermott, you'll find her and her colleagues in The Democrat and Chronicle. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
As always, short break, more connections coming up.